I'll introduce Stephen quickly, but let me pray. Father, we ask in Jesus' name that you would quicken our minds, quicken our hearts. That, Lord, some of us come tonight heavy and we're burdened, and I pray that all that would be taken from us right now, that it would all roll off of us as we roll our cares onto you because you care for us. Open our hearts, open our ears to hear the voice of the Spirit now, in Jesus' name, amen. Stephen Mansfield, heard him last year in Nashville, and I was mesmerized by the talk, and then I had his book, Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, in my bag. I devoured that book. I've taken a few of you guys through it. We're going to be starting some groups to read the book together, high school dads and I, and some other groups. But Stephen is an international speaker. He leaves from here. We want to pray for him tomorrow because he leaves from here on Monday for Iraq. And he's meeting with government officials there, and he'll explain all of that. But the man's amazing. It's been a great opportunity just to get to know him. He has our DNA, so it feels like we've known each other all of our lives. But would you welcome, please, Stephen Mansfield.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Good to see you this evening. How many of you guys weren't here last night? Good, good, good. It's good to see you guys. Thank you very much for being here. I told you last night, made a promise, you will not have to hold anybody's hand. You will not have to sing into anybody's eyes. You will not have to hug anybody you don't want to hug, okay? I know that's what scares most men, so let's lay all those fears aside, okay? I love talking to men. I love what's happening. There's kind of a global men's movement, kind of a neo-younger-aged men's movement. Some of you guys are old enough to remember that we had Promise Keepers years ago. I mean, that was kind of based out in California, so I'm sure you guys got washed with that, and I'm glad. And I think that's still happening in some ways and in some venues. My focus, much as I love Promise Keepers, has been the younger guys. Because of what I do, writing books and being on media and things like that, I end up on a lot of college campuses. And a lot of what kind of led me to what we're going to be talking about tonight is talking to younger guys, talking to millennials, we call them, and having them just look at me and go, just tell me what to do. Just tell me what to effing do. I need to know what to do. Nobody's ever told me. I didn't have a father. Nobody's ever told me what to do. And that's what got me realizing that the older of us, the boomer approach, so to speak, to manhood, was a bit more therapeutic. You know, you older guys know what I'm talking about, a bit more healing the masculine soul, a bit more, father wound kind of orientation. We're all going to need that. But the younger guys tend to be more about just tell me what to do. They're a little less therapeutically oriented. So tonight, I'm just going to hit to it. And with Buzz's permission, I'll try to leave a little time at the end of each session for a few questions, because I've learned that, you know, I talk faster than a Yankee on drugs. It's what my Southern relatives say. I'm not on drugs tonight. You're going to think I am by the time I'm done, but I'm not. And I want to make sure that I don't just talk so fast that you guys don't get a chance to sort of chat. Let me start with a story tonight. And you guys won't mind if I'm kind of off-center. I'll walk around a little bit and kind of get with you. Let me start with a story that happened to me a few years ago. It was pretty significant. For reasons I don't really need to go into, I was going and coming from Iraq. I'm not never in the military. That's not what it was about. It was relief work amongst the Kurds in northern Iraq. And I might tell you a little bit of what I'm doing there here tomorrow when I leave Monday. But as a result, normally I flew into Damascus and went on through the Syrian desert, and, you know, our team got into the Kurds in the northern part of Iraq pretty easily. This one time, though, my paperwork got messed up. So I got stuck in Damascus. Now, that sounds, you know, scarier than it actually was then. Now, of course, Syria is a mess. But back then, Damascus was a very cool city. But I got stuck. I got stuck there for 2 solid weeks. I'm going to tell my grandkids about it like I'm Lawrence of Arabia, but I mean, I was sitting in a Sheraton eating bad hamburgers and, you know, gaining weight on pistachio nuts. That's pretty much what was going on. What I had at that time a friend in the Syrian parliament. Again, that all sounds very cool and sexy, but back then that was no big deal. Now it would be, you know, I'd have to be almost a member of Al-Qaeda, I suppose, to have that, but I'm not. But back then I had a friend in the Syrian parliament, and he got kind of, you know, sad for me that I was this American stuck in Damascus and couldn't move on because of the weird paperwork. So he decided to have a little party for me, and he had it on the roof of a hotel in downtown Damascus. So we went up on the roof of this hotel. He was so sweet, gathered a bunch of his friends. And the problem was that I don't speak any Arabic, and none of them spoke any English. So, you know, it pretty much was a party, you know, that went like, you know, me sitting there and Arab guys looking at me going, welcome, you know, and then 15 minutes later, welcome to you, you know. And they're sweet as they could be, but we couldn't speak to each other, which only deepened whatever loneliness I was feeling after being stuck at the Sheraton eating bad hamburgers. Finally, an older guy turned to me and he said, in more English than I knew he had, do you have a son? And I said, I do. What is his name? If you guys have Arab friends, I have lots of Arab friends, you know, they can't ask to pass the salt without it being fairly demonstrative, right? And so, what is his name? You know, I said, his name is Jonathan. And he stepped back and, you know, like he had just announced the beginning of the world, you know, then you have a new name. Well, first of all, I wondered where did this guy's English come from? You know, I mean, I've been sitting there all night, you know, who are you? But then he said that two or three times, and finally I went and got a waiter who spoke fluent English, and I said, what is going on? Well, it turns out that in the Arab world, when a man has a son, it's such an honor to him that they actually give him an honorary name. And it's Abu, which means father of, and then a shortened version of the son's name. So this guy turned to me and said, you are Abu John. He stepped back like, you know, something like smoke was going to appear and our angels or whatever, you know. Bam, you are Abu John. And when this was announced, I'm telling you, the guy who was in charge of the Syrian parliamentarian did that Arab thing where they clapped their hands in the air and that's a signal for something. I mean, food came out, baklava, lamb, you know, it just kept coming. And then the dancing started. And I don't know if you guys know much about Arabic dancing. Men usually dance together, and it's kind of like... The problem was that half these guys were bodyguards, so they had Uzis. So it went like this. And so when the guy you're dancing with has an Uzi, he leads, okay? And so we danced, ate, shot Uzis, and the guys still didn't speak, except for the one guy who spoke a little bit more English, the waiter left. The one guy finally just, you know, they'd come up to me and they'd go, Abu John, you know, like that was the big conversation. And we went on till about 2 or 3 in the morning, you know. It was a little unusual, but they danced and celebrated that I was Abu John, you know. Now, I didn't have the heart to tell them that my son was like 10 years old. You know, they were celebrating me like this had just happened yesterday, you know. So we finished all that up. They drove me back to my hotel. They backslapped me out of the car. I went inside. And even before I went to sleep, something had changed. Something was different. I just felt different. Got up the next day, and I mean, I really had to sit still and figure out what had happened. And I finally realized what it was. Now, let me tell you before I tell you exactly what it was, that by this point, I'd had a pretty full life. I was in my 30s. I'd grown up the son of a military man, so I'd lived, you know, overseas in military culture. I was an army brat. Father was a colonel, an intelligence guy. So I spent most of my years in Germany. You know, I went to, like most of you guys, went to high school, graduated college, you know. None of that had anything to do with any kind of manhood. None of that was particularly special. By this point, I was working on a doctorate. I was a pastor of a fairly good-sized church in Nashville. You know, had children. I had lived a pretty decent life, played football, etc. I'll tell you what I figured out that it was. No one at any stage in my life had ever welcomed me to any phase of manhood, ever. I'm not Jewish. We're not Jewish, most of us, I assume. And so we don't have a bar mitzvah. You know, at age 13, you become son of the covenant. We have maybe wonderful lives, but at no time had anyone ever welcomed me to manhood, and anyone ever affirmed manhood, anyone ever said to me, you know, we've got you, we're ahead of you, we know what you're going through, we celebrate you, and we'll be there for you. You know, of course, these guys couldn't be, but you understand what I'm saying. There had never been a ritual in my life welcoming me or affirming me as a man, welcoming me to manhood or affirming me in any part of manhood. Now, I'm not, you know, I'm not ritual poor. I'm not going around going, please affirm me, you know. But what I am saying is I got up the next day, and let's be honest about it. These guys were Syrian parliamentarians with Uzi-carrying bodyguards. I found out later that most of them are registered as terrorists with our State Department, but they were in the Syrian parliament. I mean, so here I am. I'm all kind of affected and impacted and moved because some guys I can't talk to who are of a faith that I'm not part of in a part of the world I don't live have affirmed me as a father, and it's changed me in some way. Right? I mean, and I don't mind saying that. They're my friends. I haven't been in contact with most of them, but the one since then. They're all Muslims. One guy was a Syrian Christian. So if a bunch of guys I can't talk to and are from the other part of the world from a faith that's, you know, foreign to mine can affirm me as a father and it changes me, something's lacking, right? I mean, again, I went through what you guys went through. I graduated from high school, had nothing to do with manhood. Nobody said anything about manhood or stepping from teenage years into college years or anything. Graduated from college, same thing. Nobody said anything to me about manhood. I got married, you know, the night before I got married, my father-in-law turned to me and said, let me tell you a principle. Women don't mix. That's all he said. I still don't know what it means. Women don't mix. I mean, that's all he said. I had kids. Awesome. Delighted to have kids. But you know how that is, guys. You have the children. You're excited about it. They come. And then the mother-in-law mafia moves in and sweeps you out in the backyard and takes over that process. Love my mother and all my mother-in-laws. That's fine. But you understand what I'm saying. None of this has anything to do with manhood. Nobody's talking to us about manhood. Nobody's saying anything about manhood. Nobody's affirming us about manhood. So when I came back from this trip, I got to tell you that I began to look at manhood differently because I wasn't walking around in some feeling of being unwhole as a man. But I knew that something had been missing, that if I could feel tribe and affirmation and ritual and confirmation and commission from these guys, right? I mean, these guys, something was going on that wasn't quite as it should have been. And so I began to come, I came back, I was working at a large church in Nashville. I began to look at the scriptures a little bit differently. And the first thing I came across was David's commission to Solomon as David is passing from this life. And you've heard this verse before. It's on the screen. David turns to Solomon and says, I'm about to go the way of all flesh. So in this translation, it says, so be strong and act like a man. That's good, and it was important. And the reason it was important was I knew a little bit of Hebrew, and I knew that the word man here did not mean male. No father would turn to his, you know, Solomon was 20-something by this point, and say, be a male. That was decided long before. The word means the characteristics of a man, the ways of a man, the life of a man. Live out, David is saying, what it means to be a man. It's one of the three or four times in the entire Bible that the word man doesn't mean male. It means the ways of a good man, a noble man, a righteous man. In fact, I like the way that it's said in the King James a little bit better because that actually captures this feeling that it's not just about being a male. It says, show yourself a man. And even though that's old language, that's actually a better translation of the Hebrew because the Hebrew, again, doesn't mean be a male. Again, that would make no sense. The Hebrew means, again, be a great man. So show yourself a man. Well, I came across another verse very, very much like that. I love the book of Job. You guys have probably read the book of Job. It's one of my favorites in the Bible, and that's unusual. Most people don't like it. Job is the book where for a couple of chapters, Job's life comes apart, and then we have to sit through 34 chapters while his idiot friends give him bad advice, right? At the end of that process, God shows up. And I love what God says to the idiot friends. He says, excuse me. Did you teach the horse how to run? Did you put the stars in the sky? Did you build the mountains? Then shut up. Excuse me. And he goes on for like that for three chapters, basically saying, unless you did all these things, be quiet. And then he turns to Job and he says, brace yourself like a man, or prepare to defend yourself like a man. Again, the word that's used is the word descriptive of the ways of a man, the nature of a man, the ways that a man ought to be, if he's good, noble, etc. It doesn't just mean male. So as I began to read these verses, I began to realize that, you know, there's something that we had been missing. Now, the Promise Keepers thing had sort of graced the edge of my life, but for most of the men I knew, They did not have anyone around them calling them to great manhood, affirming them. Again, you have to realize I'm coming from this experience overseas where these guys who are forward in every way, I say that with love, do something about, you know, affirm me in some way as a man, and it has a real effect on me. Well, how much more if we have, an affirmation of this kind of biblical vision for what it means to be a man? And I realized the first thing I realized was positive, that we Christian men have got a code, we've got a God-given way of living, we've got a body of characteristics and a manner, a godly manner we ought to be living out that is true manhood. And then I realized how much our generation is suffering for lack of that. I realized what you already know, that our generation is seriously in trouble for the lack of genuine manhood. Now, I said before that I do a lot on the college campuses. Let me just give you a sense of what's going on in our society. I'm going to start negative and then turn the rest of our time positive, okay? On the university campus, there is serious, serious criticism of men, who they are, what their role is, and what future they might have. Let me just show you some of the books. I'm kind of a literary guy. Let me show you some of the books that are serious books by serious publishers and are taken seriously in our generation and that I contend with when I lecture or debate about men wherever I go. Look at these titles, okay? This is called The End of Men. Now, I mean, this sounds like a book that's written by somebody just to pick a fight. Serious scholar, serious book, okay? Look at this book. This is called The Demise of Guys. By the way, this author... those of you in the behavioral sciences may know the sociologist named Zimbardo. He did the famous Stanford experiment in 1972. He's one of the most prominent sociologists in our world. Look at the book he writes. He's, by the way, not believing this, but he's saying men are in demise. I know you guys came for better news than that. I'll get to it, but right now I got to tell you the bad news, okay? Look at this book. Is there anything good about men? Is there anything good about men? I want to say this is a serious book. It's a serious book written by a serious scholar. In fact, this woman, I believe, that's Roy. Roy is one of the preeminent psychotherapists in our society, a professor at the University of Florida. This is not some guy who just, wrote an e-book in his backyard and then put it on Amazon or something and has no credentials. This guy's got serious credentials. Look at the title of this book. This book's called Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Made Men Little Boys. Now, again, I didn't just go pick the most incendiary books about men. These are major titles. A couple of these have been on the New York Times bestseller list, which is not easy to do. And this is what's being described. Well, let me tell you what the prevailing theory is, okay? Let me tell you what the overall view is. I call this the guerrilla theory of men. This is my phrase, not anybody else's, because this best explains what's going on in our society. The theory is that when we needed men to settle the frontier, to, you know, build the cities, to tote the barge, lift the bale, drive off the natives or whatever, and I'm Native American by background, so, you got to talk to you about the land you owe me later, but what I'm not picking on anybody when I say that. All the things that, men were needed for when it came to muscle and brawn, as long as we needed them for that, they were valuable. But now we live in an information age. And the assumption is, in the digital age, that men don't have the aptitude, don't have the skills, don't have the emotional depth, don't have the personality to work in a digital age. So they're becoming obsolete. They're becoming unnecessary. And so now they're like gorillas in a cage, over in the corner, confused, eating a banana and scratching themselves while the women ascend. Now, this is a good moment for me to say that nothing that I'm saying in our time together is any kind of put-down of women. I am thankful for women. I believe we should be celebrating their accomplishments, and I don't believe that women have taken anything from men that men didn't surrender in the first place. So let's not turn this, I know that nobody's tempted to, this is me just talking rhetorically. I don't ever want to have this turned into some kind of anti-woman thing as I talk about men. I don't think the pie is a certain size, and we all compete for part of it between men and women. I think the pie is ever expanding. Women can rise. Men should rise. It should be a mutual admiration and encouragement society, not some competition. So nothing I'm saying is anti-woman. But this ugly creature that I look at a different screen than you guys. This ugly face that you see is what many people think that men are today. They are brawn, without intelligence, without wisdom, without gift. They go around being driven by their male parts and doing things they shouldn't do. And if you look at our world, I mean, there's an awful lot of misbehaving men in the world, and this is where that conclusion comes from. In fact, you know, Buzz has already said I do a lot in the Middle East, and I'll tell you that some of what's going on in places like the Middle East with ISIS is a lot of unengaged, angry, bitter young men who are given a cause and an excuse for violence. Well, the same thing's happening in our inner cities, and by the way, not just in our inner cities. You know, it was an upper class white kid who went ballistic on a college campus, literally, within the last few years, out of here in California. You know what I'm talking about. Young, angry men are some of the biggest problem in our society. And so the people on the campuses, sorry, pointing at the wrong screen, the people on our campuses say, well, this is why men are becoming guerrillas in our time. The great tragedy of this is what's happening with boys, okay? Because there's not a manly culture to articulate boyhood, to protect boys, to bring them up in something, for the most part, I'm not accusing you guys, of course, boys are in unbelievable crisis. What is needed is for men who know what boyhood is to articulate it to the society. Let me tell you why. We are living at a time when our society is almost, some periodicals say, declaring war on boys. And this is part of the reason why the boys look like idiots. Look at the stats. By the eighth grade, only 20% of boys are proficient in writing and only 24% proficient in reading. That's a U.S. stat. Think about that. Only about 20%. Okay? So you can imagine the school psychologists, the sociologists on campus look at stats like this. I'm going to show you some more. And they go, well, you know, obviously boys are a mess. We just need to do something with them. And the conclusion, as you'll hear me say in a moment, for the most part, is to drug them. SAT scores for boys are the worst they've been in 40 years. It's astonishing how boys are dropping. Boys are 30% more likely than girls to drop out of both high school and college. It's a horrible stat. And you can imagine what's causing this, the lack of the presence of men in the life of boys. To challenge them, to discipline them, to protect them, to defend them, it really is an astonishing thing. And I want to say quickly that this can all be turned around, but I mean, we haven't even gotten to the real horror of the whole thing. Look at this. This is something we want to celebrate, but the flip side of it for men is not a good thing. 60% of bachelor's degrees, 63% of master's degrees, and 54% of all bachelor's degrees are acquired by women. Now, I'm all for that. Hot dog. May they get, you know, thousands and thousands more. We're not against women. But this is a percentage, which means men are shrinking. Men are getting fewer of those things. Men aren't staying in school. Men aren't fitting in some way. We can talk about the reasons why. I'm happy to in Q&A. But these are the hard, cold facts. It's a pretty astonishing thing. And then we get to some of the other issues. Look at this. Boys comprise 2/3 of students in special education programs. Now, come on. If a kid needs a special education program, that's not bad. That's not a shame. Don't hear me saying that. But at the same time, if one segment of society is exploding in terms of its involvement in special education programs, something's wrong. The diagnosis is wrong. Something's wrong, right? You understand what I'm saying? And some of you may be school psychologists and so on. Let's have a discussion. I'm not anti-anything. I'm just trying to understand. Well, and you guys are familiar with this battle. The average boy today sees his first pornographic image at the age of 11. Okay? That's astonishing. And by the way, let's be blunt while we're here this weekend until noon tomorrow. We're not talking about, you know, the cover of a magazine here. We're talking about some of the nastiest hardcore porn that exists. All right? The average boy watches 2 hours of porn every week. The average American boy watches 2 hours of porn every week, okay? That can really ruin you. I grew up in Europe in my teen years, and over there they got fully nude people selling potato chips on TV, and it just about ruined me. 1 in 3 boys is now considered a heavy porn user, okay? This is what's going on because men aren't there to articulate. And then we get to the behavioral side of it, which I'm very... feel very strongly about. Boys are 4 to 5 times more likely than girls to be labeled as having attention deficit disorder. And I can't evaluate these diagnoses from a technical perspective. I can just tell you that the number of boys that are diagnosed as having this disorder is astonishing. And the main answer is to drug them. And again, I'm not trying to generate anger here in this room, but I want you to be aware that in addition of Esquire, Esquire is not exactly a Christian magazine, there was a great article by a psychiatrist, a male psychiatrist, who said, who called his article "The Drugging of the American Boy." And he said, basically, society doesn't understand boys, and so when boys act like boys, that just gives them drugs. This is his conclusion. That article, by the way, you ought to get. It's March of last year, "The Drugging of the American Boy." Let me just go ahead and I'll tell you a story from my own background. What really shows me something that's horrible, and by the way, this color you can't see well. Oh, there we go. What really, to me, has become a symbol of what's going wrong with the American boy is this word. Any doctors in the room? Any MDs in the room at all? You are? Okay, so you probably know what this word means, and you could tell us about it better than I can. I have some MDs who advise me in this great man thing, and they have urged me to mention this, that one of the fastest rising surgeries for boys is, or one of the disorders, is gynecomastia. Gynecomastia is a situation where boys, at least this is the theory of what causes this, live such sedentary lives, are so overweight, have such drugs working in them, either prescription or other chemicals that are working from junk food and so on, and apparently there's some role to be played by video games and the biochemical effect of video games on a boy, that teenage boys can begin to grow breasts. And so breast removal for teenage boys is a rising surgery in our culture. This is actually a graphic, it's going to make some of you wince, from the Mayo Clinic. I just wanted to show you that I'm not making things up. And this shows normal tissue to the left, I think, and then right on the right is what happens when a boy's body begins to grow breasts. And one of my friends, who's a surgeon, says he has removed the almost perfect American, if they were on a female, breast, what a man would like to see on a female, from boys who, of course, are being horribly traumatized by the experience. Well, again, for all I know, there's someone in here who's had that surgery. Obviously, if you need it, get it. That's not the point, is not to pick on people. The point is to say, what is going on with boys? What's going on with boys? And my response is, because there's not a noble, manly culture present, there's not a culture to bring them up in and to defend them and stand for them. Let me give you a quick example. Some years ago, my son, whose name is Jonathan, as you know, when he was about 11 or 12 years old, I was in my office in downtown Nashville, and into my room came a cop friend of mine, great big African-American cop friend of mine. I love him dearly. His name is Desmond. He's the head of the SWAT, was the head of the SWAT team in Nashville. And he had my son Jonathan by the scruff of the neck, and Jonathan, was like this, Desmond, real big muscle bodybuilder guy. And Desmond winked at me and said, "Is this your son, sir?" I said, "It is." He said, "Sir, do you allow him to lay in the street at night?" He's really putting on, turns out my son had decided to test his manhood by laying in one of the busiest streets of Nashville at night to see how close he'd let the cars get to him before he jumped up and ran to the curb. Yeah, I said he was my son. I didn't say he was brilliant. So we go through a little ritual, Desmond looks at me, "Sir, do you let your son do this?" And, he's winking at me to let me know he's putting on. Finally, he arrests Jonathan, puts him in the back of the car. Jonathan's bawling his eyes out. He's 11, and he's being a little bit roughly handled on purpose by my cop friend. Thank God it was Desmond who found him and not he didn't get hit by a car or something. So I negotiate to get Jonathan back. It's all fake, but I take him home. His mother flips out, right? She wants to hit him with a tranquilizer dart. She wants to put, a straitjacket on him. She wants to send him to military school. She's just flipped out. Now, don't misunderstand. I discipline Jonathan. I take away everything he loves. I threaten him with the fires of hell. You understand what I'm saying? He's restricted like until he's 40. You know what I mean? I just do all the things a father should do. And then when I have mother talked off the ledge, son disciplined, grandmothers and everybody backed off and so on, I went to my room and laughed my head off. Why? Because every man in this room knows what was going on. My son wanted to know, let me be a little crass, if he had a pair, right? He wanted to know if he was a man. He wanted to test himself. Every guy's done it, right? You jump off the roof, you blow up the cat, whatever it is that you got to do, right? We all, because we know in this room that adolescence is a form of madness. We all know that, right? Whether it's about women or violence or, hey, I wonder if it'll hurt if I cut my arm or whatever it is, you know? We all go crazy, and we need men around to say, this is not insanity. You do not need to drug this kid. We've all, you know, we've all been through it. Leave him alone. And all I said to everybody was, I got this. Because you know what it was a sign of? I spent a lot of time with my son. He needed more. And he also needed rougher, right? He needed rougher. We had spent a lot of time together, you know, and I was doing childhood things, going to the zoo, you know. But Jonathan didn't want to see the zebra. He wanted to ride him, kill him, eat him for dinner, you know. So I just upped my game and started taking him out and doing rowdy things. And we'd play, you know, pickup football. I mean, you understand. A father knows what to do. Everybody else thought he was crazy. Everybody else thought he was diseased. But that wasn't the deal. He just needed a man to stand with him, turn to the rest of the world and go, I got this. I know what this is. I did the same thing. I'm not even going to tell you what I did. I don't mind telling you. When I was about that age, I was living in Berlin, Germany because of my father's military career and his work in intelligence and so on. He was a Russian, specialist in Russian stuff. I tried to climb the Berlin Wall and get into East Germany. I did. I'm telling you, I did. So that's why I know that adolescence is madness, okay? But the issue is, where are the men? And I want to talk to you about two words in the Bible. You guys can tell that I love the biblical languages, and they really help us. There are two words in the Bible that really helped me come to understand what's going on with American males in our society. And again, I'm going to get to the positives and the challenges here beginning with the next session. But let me just break this out for you and continue to be a little bit on the negative side. I was reading in 1 Corinthians 6:9, and I like to read the Bible in a lot of versions, so I just happened to be reading in the King James Version. And in the King James, this verse that I'm sure you've read many times reads basically this way. Know ye not that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Be not deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, mark that word, nor effeminate, nor abusers of themselves with mankind, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor, you know, extortioners shall inherit the kingdom of God. Okay, you've read that passage before. It's a list of all the people who are, you know, apart from Jesus, committed to a horrible, destructive, sinful lifestyle, and who will not inherit the kingdom, okay? The word that caught my eye was effeminate. Really? Jesus, you're not letting the effeminate into the kingdom? Is that what that means? I mean, what does that mean? I have friends, you know, my wife's in the music industry. We live in Nashville, by the way. This is Isaac over here. He's on my staff, and he's my wife's son, and we're good friends. So if he's running around, he's official. He's got a press pass. But my wife, so we know big masculine football players. Then we know guys who are, you know, like the lead guitarist for whatever band. And from behind, they look like a woman, right? They're not that, in terms of like magazine cover, masculine. You know what I'm saying? They're men. Many of them are godly Christian men, great families, great wives, whatever. But I'm just saying, is that what Jesus is saying he's not letting into the kingdom? Guys who have a high voice or low body hair or not a lot of muscle mass? Or what is this? So I looked it up. And I'm glad I did. Because look what this word means. And man, does it describe what's going on in our society. The word effeminate is malakos. We would get our word malleable from it and so on. It means to be soft and perverse as a result of luxurious living. Now, in the Bible, you can have like a three-letter word that means like a whole English sentence. You know what I mean? I love Greek because it's so distinct. You love your hot dog, your wife, your God, your car, and your nation with different words in Greek. We just say, love it. Well, look what this word means. It doesn't really mean effeminate in that sense. It doesn't mean effeminate as in the normal, like, you know, this guy's big and muscular and this guy's slight and whatever. It means to be soft, one translation, one scholar says, tending to perversion as a result of luxurious living. Now, you know, some of you guys in this room might say, well, I'm not living in any kind of big old luxury. You know, I'm not living in a mansion or something. But let me just be honest about it. Everybody in this generation, pretty much living luxury in terms of the whole scope of history. I mean, come on. Almost all of you are carrying digital devices. None of you have missed a meal, probably. You know, you got houses. We're not worrying about the cops kicking in the back door and arresting all of us, or the, you know, the Saddam's troops or something. You understand what I'm saying? We're living in luxury. Most of you drove here in a car. We're in the scope of history, we're living in luxury. And certainly with our entertainments and what's possible and what you can see and what's available to us, doesn't mean it's inherently perverse. Doesn't mean that, you know, having a good meal, getting a massage, and watching a movie is going to make you nuts or crazy or ungodly. But you see what this means. Softness, lack of challenge, lack of guts, lack of engagement. So too much softness, too much luxury, too much ease. And it can drift us into perversion. Man, there's hardly a word that describes what's going on with the American male quite like this one. I mean that really is it to a large extent. I mean, isn't it astonishing that God gives us a technology like the internet, and what do we use it mainly for? Porn and games. That is the majority use of this amazing technology that we have, and most of that's men, sorry to say. I'll stop slapping you around in a few minutes, but I'm having fun. No, not really. There's another word that I really, really like, and it comes from Deuteronomy 20. I hope you men have read Deuteronomy 20, because it basically describes what you saw in the opening video that Buzz showed us. In Deuteronomy 20, God is telling the commanders, military commanders, what they should tell the troops before they go in the field. And it says something pretty unusual, pretty interesting. When you go to war, the officer shall say, "Is anyone afraid or faint-hearted?" And basically the conclusion is, if so, send them home. And we even heard in the video, I thought it was interesting, that this is Kenneth Branagh, one of my favorite actors in that video. What movie is that from anyway?
I'm not sure what that movie
is. Oh, I got to find that out. That was great. I didn't know the British fought in that. No, I'm just playing. Faint-hearted. What's faint-hearted mean? I mean, we don't use that word. What does it mean? And so I looked that up. The Greek version, the New Testament version of this word, is allegosuxis. You don't have to obviously write all this down. You know what it means? Allego, small, sold. Suxis is where we get our word psychology, psychiatric, psych, the soul. To be small of soul. Other ways of saying it, dim of vision, no passion. Small on the inside, we might have said in Sunday school. You know what I'm talking about. Anybody in here speak Spanish? The ganas, is that the word for desire or passion? What is that? What's that word? My Hispanic friends use it all the time. What is it? There you go. No fire, no passion, no guts, no manly drive. You know, we can come up with 50 different ways of saying it, but you know what it means. To be small souled, no sense of destiny, no sense of purpose, no sense of role, no sense of place. You know, and if you're faint-hearted, the commanders say to the guys who might go to war for Israel, go home. And the reason was, I won't roll it back to show you, but the reason was because you'll dishearten everybody else here. You'll just suck the vision out of everybody else here, and we'll lose this battle. One disheartened man. Well, we got a whole generation of small-souled men. I'm not saying that. I mean, you're here. You're sitting here on a Friday night when you could be somewhere else. I'm not trying to slap you around. I'm saying let's start with an analysis of what's going on in our society. So what's the solution? Well, if you're a righteous man, then you already know that all of the truths of the kingdom of God can be found in some version of the Andy Griffith Show, okay? If you've missed that kingdom truth, and I want to talk to your pastors and correct them. No, I'm just playing, of course. Let's watch this little funny bit of video here, and let me see if I can make a point out of it after you hear it. Okay, I love that little bit of video. And the reason is that it says what I want to say to you as we come to the end of this first session of our time together. We are the police. Who's going to fix this situation of manhood in our generation? Look around. I've given you the hard truth of what's going wrong. I could give you a whole lot more stats that would depress all of us, but between the book covers and the stats about boys, we're all about to open a vein right now, right? But what I want to tell you is I think it's fixable. I think it's reversible. I think we've got a generation of young men who, when they have a chance, want to turn. But my goal in all of this is not a big stadium event. It's not, you know, just a whole lot of, you know, groups like this, although I'm thankful for it, don't misunderstand. But my goal, my ultimate goal, is that we, as men, begin to build the culture around us that will draw other men, give the boys something to rise up into, and will spread virally and begin to create great manhood in our society. I believe we are the police. I believe we are the police. I believe that you are what I need. I am what you need. You need each other in that way. And what I'm going to do in the next 3 hours of our time together, tonight, 2 hours tomorrow, what I'm going to do is nail down some of the principles of almost, if I could put it humorously and say, fast-track manhood. Again, I'm on the campuses a lot, and the young guys say, "Touch, tell me what to do, man. I know we're all screwed up, but tell me what to do." And so I got with my team and the people that advised me years ago, and I said, okay, there's a lot of guys out there writing great books about manhood. I love the Promise Keeper stuff. I love John Eldridge. I hope you know who he is and read some of his books. I mean, Wild at Heart, one of the greatest books for men ever. But how can I teach men, to the extent that I have any influence, about how to fast-track into manhood, about how to step up, how to take a boy, college campus, 22 years old, has no idea what manhood is, has no idea how to be. I mean, never been taught. You know, I mean, really, sometimes it makes me weep to think, I don't mean to be negative here, but, you know, some of these guys, nobody even taught them how to shave. So there's, have you noticed there's a huge shaving thing happening in our country? I mean, seriously, I watch these trends and the advertisements and do what we call content analysis. You know, there's a massive shaving boom. And why is that? You know, when we drilled down into it, a couple of psychologists said, well, you know, most males in our society, nobody ever taught them how to shave. Nobody ever taught them anything. Nobody taught them about sex. Nobody ever taught them, you know, the number of men who just take some boy who's not theirs out to a prostitute on their 18th birthday is stunning. Nobody's mentoring these people in anything noble or even the practical aspects of how to be a man. So I thought to myself, well, how can I just help move them, not tell them everything they need to know, because sometimes, you know, in these meetings like this, you know, the speaker talks and it's like drinking from a fire hose. You know, it's just too much. We can't practice it. But I thought, how can I do something that allows them just to have some simple principles to move forward? You know, just the fast track. And I know that some of you, this is not your first time you've been thinking about manhood, but in the next three sessions, I want to give you four principles. That's really what I'm going to do, is I'm going to develop extensively four principles that I think will help you if you're already on your journey towards manhood. But if you're new to it, if you're young to it, if you're unformed in it, it's going to be kind of an on-ramp for you. Okay, I know that's probably a bad word in California traffic, but in the rest of the country, it's not a bad word. Kind of an on-ramp, you know, for manhood. How can I get you there and really help you move forward? And I think you'll be surprised by some of them, but that's what I'm going to pick up in just a minute. Now, do we have just a couple of minutes for Q&A, or do we need to take a break now?
I think let's take a break, okay. And then we'll do Q&A at the end of the evening. How about
that? You're the boss. Guys, good to be with you. I'm looking forward to this. God bless.
Yeah. Hey, what was that stuff about shaving? Yeah. Yeah, that stuff about shaving. Yeah. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. Bathrooms are down the hall. If you need some water, right outside.